and good morning, or good evening, wherever you may be on this round spinning globe we all inhabit. Welcome to the other side of midnight once again. I have a very interesting guest tonight, and I want to give him a proper introduction. But before we get to Don, I want to bring you up to speed on a couple of other things that we have kind of processing and tracking. One of the reasons that I wanted to call this show The Other Side of Midnight is because of what we're going to do tonight. Art had a very interesting guest on Midnight in the Desert, an old friend of both of ours, Dean Radin. And Dean is the science director of the Institute of Noetic Sciences there in the Bay Area. And, of course, he was talking about his new book and consciousness experiments, including the so-called Princeton eggs, which are these random number generators that the Institute has been able to place all over the planet in all kinds of environments and situations. And those things are dumped via the Internet to central processing, and then they cross-correlate. And the model that Radin is working on and his colleagues is that if there is a consciousness effect that we can measure with 3D instrumentation, electromagnetic instrumentation, one of the ways that it might show up is a decrease or an increase in the randomness of noise itself, electronic noise, sound noise, light noise, noise. So they have a digital mechanism for creating noise, really, really random noise, like thermal. And then they monitor how that noise spectrum changes with regard to major events, consciousness events like Diana's death some years ago, or the Challenger disaster, or things like that. And tonight he was giving Art a little update on the fact that their algorithms and their computer techniques have been improved to where they can now look at phase changes in the noise of the eggs when they're responding to a consciousness event, and the noise goes from random to semi-regular. And what Radin said tonight, which I found really remarkable, is that after literally decades of doing this, they now have, in a scientific model based on the idea that consciousness is actually what's doing the non-randomization of these electronic processes, they have a model which says, based on the data they've got, that there's about a 3 trillion to 1 odds against what they're seeing being due just to random chance or coincidence or whatever. Now, if you took 3 trillion to 1 odds to Vegas, you'd wind up owning the world. If you knew you had that in your back pocket and everything you did would actually bolster that statistical improbability, then you would wind up owning the world. You know, remember that old Star Trek episode where Sulu is describing in the first pilot version what happens to a logarithmic increase in one of the protagonist's psychic powers? And he says it's like, you know, taking a penny and doubling it every day, 2, 4, 6, 8. And so soon you'll be a millionaire. Well, with those odds, 3 trillion to 1 against chance, I find it intriguingly against chance that Art would have Dean Radin on tonight. And we were talking in the last couple of nights on our show last week about President Jimmy Carter and the idea that we could all focus, we could regularize the torsion field, we could create coherence where there's incoherence, we could add to the body of millions of people. I mean, literally millions of people around the world are all turning their attention to Jimmy Carter and wishing him well. And I thought it was fascinating that in answer to one of the questions that Art posed tonight, Radin said that it's not so much a matter of, what was the word he used? Wresting change from the ether or focusing or any of those terms. He said it's more like simply bringing attention. Now, this, of course, means that what I said on Friday night, that our relatively small group, I mean, a few thousand people doing this is not going to make a big difference, although we don't really know because we don't know the parameters. We don't know the trigger effects. We don't know the thresholds. We don't know anything except Art has a very interesting track record, an empirical track record, of using this force, this technology, this tremor in the field to fix various situations, including me. I mean, remember when I had the major heart attack, it was he calling on this audience to basically fix me, that I really believe had a substantive effect at a critical time when I was in the process of leaving this mortal coil. All that is prelude to what I was saying last week, which is if we can, as thousands of people coherently knowing exactly what we're doing, focus our attention on the president and visualize him free of cancer, normal in every way, able to continue with his incredibly productive life. I mean, I can't believe the man's 90 going on 91. He acts like somebody who's 40. I mean, his grasp of detail, his humor, his responses, his demeanor, the way he carries himself. Here is a person who is totally at ease with his existence, with his maker. And I think that's going to help us an enormous amount, because instead of fighting and resisting the idea that a higher interaction might affect him in a positive way, he would embrace it. He would acknowledge that is certainly within his view of the universe and the God that he worships. So I just want to remind you that there is no such thing as a hyperdimensional coincidence. It is resonance, and the idea that Art Tonight had a master of consciousness on to talk about actual empirical experiments that prove to the point of 3 trillion to 1 against odds that this is in fact is some measurable force that can be harnessed to be used in whatever way that we might choose, I find incredibly appropriate. And I want to remind everyone as we go through this next week to pause for a moment and focus your attention. That's all Radin says it takes based on their data. Focus your attention on Jimmy Carter and let's see what happens. Now, one of the things that Radin is doing this fall apparently is taking about 30 of these random number generators, these little eggs, and positioning them all around the Burning Tree Festival out there in the desert in the next few days. And what they're going to try to do is to see if there are spikes or moments of coherence when certain key events in the festival, like the burning of the temple or the burning of the giant effigy, that's where the Burning Man thing got its name, of course, has any measurable effect. And they've got a control set of eggs, apparently in San Francisco or on the peninsula, that they'll be comparing against. They're 200 and some miles away. And part of what they're looking to see is there a distance part of this? I mean, Radin during the show over and over again reiterated that they have found no real distance lag in terms of the effects. It doesn't matter where you are, which, of course, would be emblematic of the kind of torsion field physics that we've talked about, where time itself is also part of the mix. So think about Jimmy Carter. Think about him well. Think about the thousands upon thousands of hours of data that Radin and his colleagues have collected, which shows overwhelmingly there's something non-material, something non-EM, something non-gravitational, something outside of our science purview going on. And it would be very nice if we could harness this to not only improve Mr. Carter's life, but also to demonstrate that there is a lot more going on than most people in the daylight hours admit. And with that, let me turn to our guest of the night. I have no idea where this conversation is going. Don and I have known each other forever and ever and ever, and we haven't had a lot of conversations recently, so part of tonight's going to be a kind of a catching up. But I want to give you a perspective, which is when you take an honest individual, an honest person, who looks at a phenomenology and asks really serious questions, you wind up with that crossover between the word I hate, which is paranormal, because it really, that's kind of like a political holding term. It doesn't really mean anything. Para means alongside of, or maybe in spite of, or in other words, if the phenomenology we're looking at and talking about on this show, and that Art talks about on his show, is real, then it's merely a part of reality, of normalcy, which we haven't kind of gotten around to understanding or maybe culturally or psychologically accepting. So Don is a writer. He's a researcher and currently a commentator living in the Los Angeles area. He served as former director of research and media liaison for UFO Magazine for like two decades. Ecker is definitely an internationally renowned investigator of the UFO phenomenon. Don's also a former law enforcement officer and a criminal investigator with over a decade of that experience. So he brings legitimacy to a field that for years, as we all know, has been painted with a fringe brush, and he has written in service to that ideal numerous articles for UFO publications, including UFO Magazine, as well as articles for international publications, the United Kingdom's 40 and Times, for instance, and Omni, and the old CompuServe system, and the Paranet computer database. Don became interested in the UFO question in 1966, when along with several other people, he was witness to a sighting of the Enigma. I was unwilling, he said. It was unwilling, rather. It was unlike, he said, anything I'd ever seen before, and I realized then there was much more to this than the authorities were letting on. After graduating from high school in 68, Ecker attended college for about a year, and then he enlisted in the United States Army. He was selected for the Elite Army Security Agency, where he volunteered for special operations. He served in Southeast Asia, which obviously is a code for Vietnam, for about 26 months, I'm sorry, was wounded twice, decorated, and then returned. Because he'd been wounded, he was forced to retire, and when he went back to school, he realized that he obviously really wanted to be back in investigation, so he applied to his hometown's police department, where he became an officer. In 1986, while a member of the department's SWAT team, Ecker was wounded again, which led to his retirement. While recuperating, he started to research and write on the UFO mystery, and as a criminal investigator in 82, he had been leading an investigation of several cattle mutilations, which he later discovered were somehow connected to UFOs. Don, good morning.
Dick, how are you? It's been, a very long
time. It's been longer than we should probably tell everybody on the air.
Yes, yes.
Busy lives. So you really started out as a police guy and wandered into this Hall of Mirrors quite by accident.
Well, yeah, it was basically something I stumbled over after I was hurt. In 86, I purchased my first computer system in 1987. Then I discovered CompuServe, $6 and I think it was 40 cents an hour at 300 baud.
Oh, my God. Which, remember that?
Yes. which was, you could actually sit and watch paint dry. notes and messages. But
hey, I had an old Model 100. I wrote half of my first book on a Model 100 from Radio Shack.
Tandy?
Tandy, good old Tandy.
I got one in my office right here.
Oh my God, I've got one in the garage somewhere.
I got one in the office.
And remember how you had to record your data?
Yeah, on a magnetic tape.
A little cassette recorder. And it would go beep, beep. Beep, 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 and it would take... Go ahead.
They were fun.
Well, they were fun, but they only showed you, what, 8 lines? I mean, that was really... Of course, up until then, I was using 4 or 5 gallons of whiteout, a day, so it was a major step forward. Major step.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that geometrically progressed along. It was unbelievable what is available today. But at any rate... I discovered CompuServe, and I was on one of the forums called the Issues Forum, and I stumbled over a number of files that had been uploaded there discussing, among other things, UFO sightings. I'll never forget the Japanese JAL commercial flight above Alaska that encountered a humongous unknown. The captain had talked about it. That file was up there.
Yeah, that was over Alaska. And it was a 747.
Right.
And he was kind of paralleling it for hundreds of miles.
Yeah, the thing.
And they had radar from the ground from Alaska.
Yeah, it was definitely an unknown. Now, you know, I've always maintained that an unknown object is not the same as an extraterrestrial craft, although people will automatically jump to that assumption.
Well, they jump there, Don, because they don't think we can do anything more than, you know, squirt stuff out the back end or rotate, you know, pieces of metal at very high speed.
But it's one of those things that, you know, it's like UFO. UFO does not mean alien spaceship. What it means is an unidentified flying object. I use that term in the exact same way that the Air Force did when they originally coined it. But, you know, it's been so used, so overused.
Yeah.
That today, when you hear UFO, look for the guy's tinfoil hat.
Well, we know the CIA began deliberately, a la the Robertson panel, in the 50s, to devalue the language to where no ordinary upstanding citizens could report something like this without being laughed out of town.
Exactly, and it was a deliberate act. But at any rate, Dick, to get back to this mutilation thing, I came across one or two files on cattle mutilations, and suddenly the light clicked on, and I went back to in my mind to that case that I was an investigator on, and I went, oh my God, you know, oh my God. And that's when it really lit my afterburner. And for the first three or four years, that's basically what I was known for, was my research into mutilations. And then it got even darker. I don't know if you will recall this or not, but I was researching human mutilation cases.
Oh, I do remember that. And back from the 40s, I believe.
Well, it went literally, actually, from the 50s. On up through the 80s at that time. I'm talking about circa 88, 89.
Okay.
So it was, a very dark time, and trying to break through that was impossible.
Were you the first to actually look at this extrapolation of the cattle and all that into the human realm?
I want to say I was. I'm not absolutely positive. I know that there had been other people that had discussed that in very hushed tones, but I'm certainly the first one that went public with it and wrote articles about it. As a matter of fact, you can still find...
Well, you're also the first one to have a police background and actually know what you're looking at.
Well, yeah, that's probably true in this country.
How many police officers, come on, are into UFOs and looking at cattle mutilations in this time frame on the planet? Nobody but Don Ecker. Come on.
Well,
you're not the first, we'll hear from it by social media, but let's just say you're the first.
Well, it was not anything at the time that I got to tell you, Dick, that I was tickled about.
I can imagine.
Because I took a lot of slings and arrows from a lot of people about that. But
when you encountered that first case in 82, and you said you were assigned as an investigator.
Right.
How many other guys on the team?
Well, I was the non-uniformed one. There were uniformed people around there. It happened, the case happened on Halloween night.
Oh my God.
Okay. And it happened about 35 yards from the farmer's back door on his house. And he had several kids, he had dogs, his wife, of course, and none of them, even the dogs, heard absolutely nothing. He woke up in the morning, found the cow, and then called it in because it was obvious it was not a natural demise for the animal.
Hmm.
So
wait a minute. How did you guys get called in if it was just, you know, on a farm? I mean, animals die on farms all the time.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It was mutilated.
Oh, is that why they called you?
That was the case that somebody had killed this cow. Now, you know, this was in the state of Idaho, okay?
Okay.
But if you take a look, and I did, at all the surrounding states, and I'm talking about states like Colorado, states like Nevada, Washington, Montana. I mean, all these states have suffered this killing of animals in one way or another. Many of those animals are killed along the very same lines, with things like the eye being removed from the socket.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a female cow, the tits being excised. If it's a male, a bull, the scrotum and penis being excised, the rectum cored out. And it's obvious that something with apparently a very high degree of technology was doing it. But the thing that always shocked me and amazed me, and it's been a long time, Dix, I'll tell you that right now, since I've really delved into this research, but it always shocked me that so many, literally thousands of animals over the years
here in the Southwest,
exactly, have suffered this fate, and no one has ever been caught.
Hmm.
No one has ever been prosecuted. No one was ever shot, because let's face it, you're talking about some very expensive animals.
Yeah, and well, this is cattle rustling.
Exactly. Will protect their livestock. And it has just...
Now, wait a minute. Let me stop you there. You mean, I first heard of this in... I remember exactly where I was. I was in a girlfriend's apartment in New York in 1978. And this came up...
About 70, it really hit the news about 75.
I only heard about it in 78, but it was a riveting story about, you know, farmer, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember wanting to find out more. This is, of course, pre-internet, you know. And there was no way to find out in those days, because sheriffs weren't talking. You weren't on the scene yet. Linda had not appeared.
Right.
So it was just one of those haunting things, like... And this was before I got even highly interested in some of the more outrageous aspects of this phenomenology. So what did you guys think what had happened?
I did not have a clue, and I'll be very, very honest about that.
This is the case in 82.
Right. I didn't know what in the world to make out of it. We did investigation. There was another cow that had suffered the same fate over the hill from this guy's home, his farm, on another farmer's land. Okay, so they were both connected. We connected both of them together. But the one thing that I got to tell you, it spooked me. Okay, it really did. It spooked me. And, hey, I'm a guy that had been in combat.
You've been firefights, Vietnam, all that. You've seen probably hell.
Right. But you know what spooked me, Dick? There was no body fluids.
Oh, no blood?
No blood. That was the one thing. And if you talk to skeptics, and, hey, I've talked to all of them. From Phil Klass to Jim Oberg to Shake to Nickel to Michael Shermer. I mean, you know, I banked.
It's like a small rogues gallery, isn't it?
Yeah, I banked with all those fellas over various cases. And they'll always say, well, the blood goes, it's gravity. It goes to the lowest part of the body and blah, blah. Well, sorry, guys, there wasn't any blood in the animal that I could see.
So the blood had been drained.
The blood, well, it had been removed somehow. Exsanguination. It happened. I don't know how it happened, but it happened. So anyway, that was the one thing that really, really spooked me. So, what ended up happening was the department wanted to shovel the case under the rug.
Why?
And but ultimately, you know, I don't know why. I can speculate. I can give you informed speculation.
Go for it. It's the other side of midnight.
Yeah, my informed speculation was that this was such a common occurrence.
Oh.
And at that time, in southeastern
Idaho,
okay, that was certainly not the first case. It had happened in other places, Utah, Colorado, Nevada, Washington.
But if that's true, why wasn't there a kind of a buzz? Why wasn't there a, oh, you got another one of those?
Well, there was among the ranchers and the farmers.
Right.
Okay. Now, the guys that I talked to, and especially in the department, oh, yeah, 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 that's happened before. There's no reason. Well, you know, some of us think it might be a devil cult worship thing, you know, and somebody else, well, no, it's predation. It's coyotes or, you know.
Blah. All the usual, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it got shoveled under the rug.
But how did these guys explain the lack of blood? I mean, if you're a police officer, at some point in your career, you probably come up upon an accident or you're shot or whatever. There's a lot of blood.
Yeah, yeah, there is, but there wasn't here.
See, that should have been a red flag to everybody.
No.
Why?
No. It's one of those inconvenient facts, Dick. If it's an inconvenient fact, it's like the Air Force. It's like the the O'Hara UFO that popped through a cloud a few years ago. Do you remember that?
Yeah, in Chicago. Big yeah. United Airlines thing. Went on for days and days and days. And now we have social media, so everybody can send the photos and the air traffic control, you know, commentary and all that around. But nothing ever came of it.
The first thing you hear, oh, well, you know, we have an explanation on how that hole got in the cloud there. And they gave some explanation about, well, forget about the object that blew up. Okay. We're not going to talk about that because it's inconvenient.
So you're saying that bureaucracies have responded to this. What you're saying is bureaucracies have a way of responding to phenomena or stimuli that don't fit their mold. They simply ignore them.
Exactly.
Even on a criminal case.
Exactly.
That's not.
Hey, I'll give you a much more recent example. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it just shows how it works. Those three American, couple of them military, and the civilian that stopped the attack.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I meant to mention them at the top of the show. If you want to talk about the polarities in this consciousness field thing we've been discussing, you have there in that one example the worst and the best of humankind in one car on one train at one moment.
And thank God those guys were there and on the ball.
Yeah.
They stopped what could have been an absolutely
A nightmare massacre. A nightmare massacre, and they intervened. And see, that's what I'm trying to get at with this show about bigger things, which is consciousness-wise, we're entering, Don, a period where there's more and more obvious polarities, good guys and bad guys. You know, I've been saying the good are getting better and the bad are getting worse. Well, the good and the bad in one incident is exquisitely encapsulated in what those guys did to take down a really, really bad guy. And it's amazing to me what France has done. It's kind of like they remember.
Well, the French just presented these fellows with the Legion of Merit.
I know.
High award.
Yep.
Decoration. Okay. And
by the way, politically is really good because you want more good guys to take the initiative when they see something weird.
Oh, yeah. And the Air Force is going to give its highest non-combat award for heroism to one of those fellows.
Okay. Do you have their names in front of you?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
Google is our friend, folks. Please get us the names. I'd like to mention their names before we go off the air because I didn't put the link up tonight. I should have.
But, you know, now all this is happening with these guys. A couple of them were injured. One fellow was injured badly.
Yeah.
Had his thumb taken off.
Were they able to replace it?
Well, they reattached it, yes.
Oh, he should then be in great shape because the technology of that has advanced incredibly.
Oh yeah, well it's going to be hard probably to use for a while, but yeah, thank God they were able to reattach it. But so far the president hasn't even acknowledged these fellows. So you see how the bureaucracies can just shovel this stuff right off, okay? Just totally ignore it.
Now, why would you say there's a conscious effort to ignore it?
I'm not saying it's a, well.
I mean, here you have three American heroes.
Right.
And they did a superb job. They put themselves in harm's way.
You would think, Dick, you would think that the president of the United States would acknowledge that.
Well, he's probably going to invite him to the White House. And, you know, the White House loves to do things in a big way. So he's not going to, you know.
We'll see.
Want to make a bet?
We'll see.
I'll make you a bet.
You'll make me a bet?
I'll make you a bet Obama invites him to the White House. Come on. Cannot.
Well, it took them, what, 3 or 4 days to lower the flags to half staff when those 5 service members were killed down in, was it Memphis?
Yes.
Yeah, now, you know, as a former military guy, I got to tell you, that cut deep into me.
Obviously, there are bureaucratic problems, but I don't think in terms of Obama himself that he's not watching this.
Dick, if you're the president, to say, lower those flags. Took them 4 or 5 days. That's all you got to do. Lower the flags. We just lost 5 service members. Didn't happen until there was an outcry.
Well, I just think that these guys are going to have the appropriate fuss made over them because they need to be role models. They need to
I hope so. I sure hope so.
And, well, I'll just make this a little quiet bet. I'm very good at winning bets, as you may have heard.
Well,
certainly political bets.
Well, this should go far and above.
So you were bringing them up as an example of how what? The bureaucracy does not pay attention to certain things?
Exactly.
Okay.
Or by design does not pay attention.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting in this case that that's what happened, but I'm just saying by a lot of these cases, the case with the mutilated cattle was certainly one.
Okay, well, hold it right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. I actually blew past the break because you and I got into an intriguing conversation, which, of course, is kind of what this show is supposed to be about. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest is Don Ecker, a police investigator who tripped over mutilated cattle in the early 1980s, and it changed the direction of his life. We'll be right back. We're back on the other side of midnight with my guest this morning, Don Ecker. Don, please continue.
Where were we?
We were talking about the guys in France as examples of how bureaucracy can be kind of in denial, although I don't think that quite fits. I think we need another example. I'll tell you where bureaucracy is in denial, and we're going to do a whole show on this tomorrow night from an extraterrestrial perspective. I'm giving everybody a kind of a hint. Hillary's server.
Okay.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Why would you, as a prospective presidential candidate, with all kinds of plans, serving in the highest, you know, office, non-elected office in the land when it comes to foreign policy, as Secretary of State, why would you possibly, on a million different realms of interdimensional simultaneity, why would you put the government business of the United States on a private server with a backup in a bathroom in Denver? Unless, are you with me so far?
Is that a rhetorical question?
I'm getting to the punchline here. You had something really, 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 really big to hide. And so we're going to get into that tomorrow night, what Ms. Clinton might be hiding on her private server. So,
well, I could just jump in here real quick.
Absolutely. That's what, you're the guest. Come on.
Throw my 25 cents worth, and I can do it in one word.
Okay.
Benghazi.
So you think that's the reason?
I think that's a big reason.
Okay.
Yeah, but hey, look, Dick. Now you gotta, you know, it's one thing. When I was a detective, I had to learn the hard way that you've got to try to look at the whole picture. Okay, the whole picture. To try to get an idea of what the motives might be of something, what this suspect, for example, the suspected perpetrator, what they may or may not have done in the past. You got to look at the whole shooting match. And, hey, it's obvious that with Mrs. Clinton and her husband, former President Bill Clinton, I really, truly believe that they thought the rules applied to you and I, the common folk, but not to them.
Okay, so, but and that still doesn't answer the question, what is so huge that you're willing to risk? And by the way, this whole server thing was set up years before Benghazi. It was set up when she became Secretary of State in 2009.
Yeah, but look what happened when they were subpoenaed. Okay.
Yes.
And they wanted the server. What happened?
Well, she admits that it was wiped.
The server got wiped after.
With a nice little rag that she said at her press conference.
With a cop or something.
Hey, look, let's not do this tonight. Would you like to join our conversation tomorrow night? Because that's when we ought to focus on Hillary, because we've got some remarkable new insights into what might be going on.
Oh, I don't want to hog. I don't want to hog.
No, I'm the guy that does the conversations. I wouldn't have invited you if I didn't want you to be part of the crowd.
Well, let me see if I last through 2 a.m. my time today, okay?
That's why Art always used to tell me, take a nap.
Yeah, well, I tried today twice.
Oh.
Twice. I laid down, and I did not nap. But I've got my iced tea here, so I'm getting
charged. All
right,
let's not beat to death poor Hillary. We're going to do that tomorrow morning. Let's move on from when you're looking at this mystery. You're realizing that folks don't really want to grapple with the mystery, and then you put it aside. You get shot, you have to retire, and then you begin to kind of reconnect with these mysterious investigations that never had an answer.
Yes, and, you know, I remember vividly, and I saw it when it aired, and I was in Denver, when Strange Harvest aired with Linda Moulton Howe.
Yep.
And this was before my experience, okay? So I'm sure that some of that was floating around in the back of my head, although I got to tell you, I did not make the connections in 82. It wasn't until 87, 88 that it really came home for me. But I gotta say that, you know, this was something on the one hand. The cattle was one thing. But when I came across the human aspect to it, that's when I really got obsessed. And I really went full bore for 3 years. And one of the things that I don't know if you ever heard this story or not, Dick.
Try me.
Okay. I had, after I was medically retired, and I still had a lot of buddies, a lot of friends that were on police departments around the country and where I was located at then. And I was curious to find out what might be in the NCIC computer system, the database,
mm-hmm.
Washington. So
you might explain for folks that aren't familiar, like me, what's the NCIC computer?
Okay, this is a database that
the Center for National Criminal Investigations or something,
right? That is handled by the FBI.
Oh, okay.
And the FBI, of course, has all this information. It was computerized, and the only way that you can get into this computer is through a department, you know, through a request and so forth. There's a protocol that you have to follow.
Sure.
And then the data spits out.
In those days, it was probably, what, a teletype?
Yeah. We're talking, 80, 88. We're talking 1988.
Okay, teletype.
I had a buddy that was on one of the sheriff's departments down the road from me. I was working for the, well, until I retired, I was with the state. I had a buddy that was in the Boise PD. And then I had another friend that was back in Ohio that was a working cop. And I contacted these guys, each individually, and I said, look, I came across something because a friend of mine, who at the time was the MUFON state director for the state of Idaho, called me up one afternoon. And this is after I started getting, you know, around the edges, I was getting involved. And he called me up and he said, hey, Don, he said, look, he said, I've got something here. He said, I want to talk to you about it. He said, could you come over to my home? And I said, sure. I said, what is it? He said, well, I don't want to go into it on the phone. Now, when he said that, intrigued me. Okay.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. So I jumped in my car and I drove over. And he said, did you hear about that hunter that had been discovered in the woods dead? Now, Dick, it's not unusual, okay, in a place like Idaho, which has some very rough terrain, for somebody to, you know, be killed in an accident, fall, you know, off a ledge, you know, into a canyon, or break a leg, and you know, it. I mean, these kind of things.
We had a case here just a few weeks ago. The former White House chef was actually hiking north of us here, north of Albuquerque, up near Santa Fe, and he wandered away from his car and got stuck, and he died. I think he died in a flash flood, if I'm not mistaken. So, yeah, walking and hiking in the desert or the mountains can be very hazardous to your health.
Exactly. Well, what happened to this guy was when his body was found, okay, his body was nude except for a pair of underwear that he still had on him. But he had been mutilated in the classic sense.
Oh,
Yeah. And this came, incidentally, from a police officer to my friend, who was the MUFON state director.
Right.
And I was intrigued, and I said, no, wait a minute. What is it you're telling me? He said, well, the guy's possessions, his clothing and his boots, okay, were found about a mile and a half, 2 miles away. And he was originally had gone hunting, and then, you know, here he is, mile and a half, 2 miles away from his possessions, nude, dead, mutilated.
But wearing his underpants.
He had his underpants on, but no shoes, no socks. And here was the amazing thing, because I asked specifically about this. His feet were clean.
So he hadn't walked the mile in the desert.
No, in the woods. No.
Okay.
His feet were clean. Now, you know, the first thing I thought of.
Well, he had to have been abducted.
Somebody abducted. Somebody had a beef with this guy. Somebody abducted him and then killed him. But no, that's not what it was. Because of the mutilation, his sexual organs had been removed, his rectum had been cored. I mean, this is some pretty...
This is the classic cattle mutilations transferred to this hunter.
This is some grisly stuff. Yeah. Now, that is what put me on the trail.
What about his eyes?
Well, one eye had been removed.
Does it strike you that this is overtly symbolic and ritual? Like someone's trying to communicate something through symbols as opposed to a language?
I hadn't thought that far.
Okay.
Because it was, you know, just the grisliness of it. You know, I wanted to see the perpetrator.
And you're still thinking we're dealing with a human being who's a
right.
Know,
until I started doing some real in-depth armchair at the time, armchair, because I wasn't officially working with anybody, just myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I had occasion that I met John Keel.
And what year was this again?
88.
Okay, so you're just at the beginning of the internet.
The internet was not around, but you know, CompuServe was.
Well, that's the beginnings of
It was soon to come online. There were a couple of Delphi, I believe, was around, but they were all separate services. So I got in touch with John Keel. Now, I knew Keel, not personally, but I had known him from 1975-76.
You might mention who John Keel is.
Well, John Keel was a prolific author, writer, researcher.
Kind of like a modern Charles Fort.
Exactly. Well, yeah, he was a Fortean. I asked him one time, well, you don't call yourself a ufologist? And he got angry. So, no, I'm not a ufologist. I'm a 410.
Good for him.
John.
Well, he's trying to get to the bigger picture because UFOs are only part of this orchestra.
Well, he had written the Mothman Prophecies.
Okay.
Now, this was a, you know, and there are a lot of people out there that are detractors of Keel. And believe me, I am not one of them. That was a landmark book for me. I still have my copy that I bought. I specifically went down and ordered it from my local bookstore in 1975 when I first heard about it. So at any rate, we had a long conversation. And later when
you in Idaho, he's in Texas.
No, he was in New York.
Oh, okay. Okay.
No, John was in New York. So we started talking about this, and I told him about this case in it was outside of Jerome, Idaho. And then Keel got very quiet. And then he said, well, you know, he said, that's certainly not the only one.
Oh.
And I said, well, give me another example, John. And then he told me about a case that he had looked at that I later looked into, where just below the border of Texas in Mexico, driving up north toward Texas, a guy and his wife were tooling along the road, had been down in Mexico probably, I don't know, for a vacation or something. This is years ago, too. This is not recent. This is they weren't dodging the cartels.
Okay.
But out of the clear...
Like that poor couple from Santa Barbara a couple of years ago.
Yeah, out of the clear blue sky, a severed human torso dropped from the sky and hit the road.
What?
A severed torso.
I heard you. I can't believe it. In front of them? In front of the car?
Yeah, right on the highway.
It was like something out of X-Files.
And they slammed on the brakes, jumped out. They didn't see anything in the sky. It was
daylight.
Daylight, sure.
No clouds.
When he first told me about this, huh?
No clouds.
No, nothing that they were able to see. I guess for a long ways, and they didn't see anything. So I mean, this was the second case I had heard about. And then I started doing some digging. So I called up my buddies.
Well, wait, what happened to the headless body that fell from 20,000 feet?
Well, the Mexican authorities came out, took a look at it, picked it up, and that was it. They had no explanation for it.
And they never ID'd it?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Hmm. Okay.
No. So at any rate, so I...
That's a real bummer for a vacation. I mean...
Well, the end. Thank God it was at the end of the vacation, right? But you'll certainly have something to tell your grandkids about. So when I started putting these cases together and, you know, now I'm not in any way am I thinking at the time E.T., okay?
This is 86. You just retired. You're looking at these little anomaly thingies. You're making patterns. But you're not thinking, I mean, a body falls out of the sky and you're not thinking maybe it's not a human perpetrator?
Well, I Dick, that's jumping way ahead. And it's not something that a good investigator, a good researcher, you know, does. They may allow something like that to play around the fringe of the mind, but...
I'm just wondering when your aha moment came.
Well, you see, this is one of the problems in this field, especially today. I have come across this many, many times. People have a preconceived notion about what they think something may be, i.e. aliens, mm-hmm. i.e. Alien abductors, abductions, mutilations. It's got to be E.T. Well, you know, that's a far stretch. And so what they will do, they will lay aside good research, good investigation, and they'll work specifically to try to prove their thesis, okay, at the expense of what the facts may be. And I, honest to God, I try not to do that. So when I heard this and I thought, well, okay, all right, now I think I have enough that I'm going to go and I'm going to see if I can get some more information. So what I did was I called up my buddy at the Boise PD, a detective, and this is 88 now, okay? Mm. So this is, my God, it's almost 30 years ago.
Mm. Isn't it amazing how we can remember stuff like this?
And I called him up, and I said, hey, look, this is what I'm doing. I said, do you know about this case? And I told him about this case in Jerome, Idaho. And I said, I want to do a little experiment here. I said, I was involved in some mutilation with domestic animals on a farm. And now this kind of is a sticky wicket. So this is what I'd like to do. I'd like you to make an inquiry to the NCIC. And this is the criteria. Any unexplained homicides with these mutilation markings, and I told them what I was looking for, and I said, specifically in the states of Idaho, Nevada, Washington, Utah, and Montana, because all those states are all clustered, you know, in one kind of geographical, large geographical location, but one location. And then I called up my buddy about a day later that worked at a sheriff's department. And I said, Russ, I said, this is what I'm looking for. I said, and I gave him the same information. Then I called my friend Dale back in Ohio, and I gave it to him. Well, I shouldn't have done that, Dick.
Hmm.
Because when I talked to Chip, who was at the Boise PD, and I said, look, how long do you think this will take? And he said, probably at least I would think a week, because they're going to have to look at, you know, remember, there was still at that time, Dick, the Green River Killer had not been caught yet.
Okay.
And they thought, here was a guy that was responsible for 40 plus homicides. And most of them, okay, had been mutilated,
mm-hmm.
Had been tortured, mutilated, and they didn't know who they were looking for. The guy primarily went after, he was after prostitutes, but he also got some other women, but they hadn't caught him yet.
Kind of a Jack the Ripper.
Exactly. So he said, you know, it's probably going to take a good week anyway.
Okay,
so I
let me stop you there, because we're talking to a whole bunch of millennials who basically think that your friend took out his smartphone, punched in a few keys, and at the speed of light, information that would fill five computers came flowing down the pipe. But actually, there's a whole bunch of people looking through mechanical files, and then they write a report and they send that a week later after they've gone through, what, 5-10 yards of paperwork?
Yeah, something like that.
So that's the system that existed.
Yeah, we didn't have smartphones. As a matter of fact, I didn't. You know, I bought my first cell phone about 4 years after that, Dick. It was a Radio Shack brick.
Mm.
And I paid almost $400 for it.
The famous brick.
Cost $1.65 a minute to use it.
No.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to carry it around in a suitcase. So,
Well, look, again, we're dealing with an audience that hasn't a clue that people actually went to a physical file cabinet, opened up a drawer, and sorted through cardboard folders.
Yeah, it's a different world, kids.
Yep.
It's a different world.
So moving on.
So, you know, I sat back and I thought, well, okay. Well, I got three inquiries out there. I got to hit pay dirt somewhere. Well, about two, maybe it was 3 days later, my buddy at Boise PD calls me. And I answered the phone and I said, oh, you got some information already. He said, no. Hmm. I said, well, what's going on? He said, what in the hell did you get me into?
Oh, it was red flag.
Oh, yeah, it was. Oh, you better believe it was.
Hmm.
And
you hit a tripwire. Ding, 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 ding.
I said, what do you mean? He said, look.
You had three of them coming in.
Yeah. He said, I had my lieutenant called me in, and he said, and he spent the last 20 minutes chewing on my tuchus about this. And he said he was not happy. He wanted to know what was going on. I said, well, what happened? He said, well, they sent me a notice back that they had zero cases of unexplained homicides, especially with mutilation.
But you just had the Green River case.
That's my point, Dick. That's my point. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That was the point. I knew that. I knew it then.
So you got them between crossfire.
Yeah.
You knew they had to be lying.
Well, of course they were lying.
There's no of course in life. You have to prove every case, but in this case, you got a hell of a case.
Well, then Russ called me, and basically it was a repeat of the same thing. He said, well, I'm not doing that again. And I said, okay. And then I heard from Dale. Now, Dale, who was back in Ohio, was not a full-time officer. He also worked at another job. I'm not going to say what job. But he worked at another job for the government. And he was working as a part-time cop. And he was not happy. So I sat down with all of this information.
And hold it there. We'll be right back. We're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is Don Ecker. We're talking about the making of a UFO ET investigator from a hardened cop. We'll be right back. Back on the other side of midnight with my guest Don Ecker, and we stopped at a particularly pregnant pause, so if you will resume.
You betcha. So the bottom line was that I began to write up a report, and originally it was going to be specifically for the Mutual UFO Network from my buddy who was a state director.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this thing up, and I gave it to him, and he read it, looked at it, and he started to make it available. Now, somewhere along the line of the nascent internet, this thing got put up online. Now, at the time, Dick, now, I didn't mention the ParaNet system. Now, for especially the younger crowd out there, ParaNet was basically the first UFO-centric, paranormal-centric computer service that came together. Now, this was before the free-flowing internet. Basically, what you had were ParaNet nodes around the country and around the world, because ParentNet became a worldwide service, not only all across the United States, but also in England, France, Russia, had ParentNet nodes, Australia, Japan.
Mm-hmm.
This was kind of an internet before there was an internet. ParentNet was originally started in about 1986 down in Flagstaff, Arizona. You knew Jim Spicer, didn't you, Dick?
Oh, yeah.
Jim Spicer was the guy that that began ParentNet. And a year or two later, he handed over the reins to a guy that became very close friends with me, a fellow by the name of Michael Corbin, who later became a known and noted radio broadcaster in his own right, and died a few years ago while he was driving somewhere. He had a stroke. He had pulled over to the side of the road. I guess he was feeling ill. He had a stroke. And they didn't find his body for a day or two after he passed on, which I was totally shocked when I heard about that. But that was Mike Corbin. But Mike put the thing out there. I guess that's where it really ended up. Probably first was on the ParentNet. But then the thing got around, and I began doing some more research.
So this was your report, basically looking at this pattern of human mutilations and making the direct correlation for the first time with the cattle?
Right. And
what did you call the paper? Since people can obviously now search.
Hume Mute. But you got to remember, back in those days, you had to have that truncated title.
Oh, you mean you could only use 8 letters?
I don't remember. I think it might have been 7 or 8 letters. But, Dick, then something very strange happened.
So this is making the rounds in the quasi, almost not yet internet, pre-internet, and something happened.
A lot of people obviously thought I was out of my gourd, okay?
Well, in those years, yeah.
They thought I was totally out to lunch.
And they threw out all your investigative background, your Army service, the fact you'd been wounded in service to your country, that you were a realist, an empirical research kind of guy, because of the subject.
Exactly. The subject. The subject matter is the first thing. You know, let's relegate that to the round file.
Mm.
But I had a call from a guy. Now, this was... this is going to sound even more X-Files, okay?
Hey, you're on the other side of midnight. Go for it.
I had a call from a guy who identified himself, and he told me, I mean, I believed him, that he was a DEA agent in Florida. Okay? He was down in Florida.
Now, he's calling you in Idaho.
He's calling me in Idaho. And
has he seen this report floating around?
Oh, yeah.
That's why he called you.
That's why he called me.
Okay.
He called me, tracked me down. And he said, I read your report. And he said, I got to tell you. He said, I thought you were full of BS. I said, okay.
One cop to another.
Yeah. He said, I decided to do some background checking on this. And he said, I made some inquiries. And he said, the first thing that happened, and I'm just telling you straight, Dick, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Just telling you straight. He said, flags popped up all over.
Wow.
And he said, the reason I'm calling you is to tell you that if I were you, I would lay off this.
Oh.
Because he said you could get yourself in a situation you don't want to be in.
Now, hang on.
It was like waving a flag at me.
Hang on. Did you get the idea that he was on the level, or he was kind of the designated guy to get you, to wave you off, one colleague to another?
At the time, I took him dead level, okay? I thought this guy was just saying it the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He was telling me that this was something that had the potential to become very ticklish, okay?
Okay.
That's as far as I'll go, ticklish. But it could prove to be very ticklish if I proceeded. Well, by this time...
That's a curious technical police term, right? Ticklish?
Yeah. I could use some other terms, Dick, but...
It's okay. It is a family show. You'd be amazed.
Yes, I'm sure. So, you know, that was like waving a flag at me. Now, I was working then. I was writing for UFO Magazine. Now, this went on for a couple of years, okay? And I was still working the case. And it was in the summer of 93 when I wrote an article because I had discovered, and once again, this is going to sound grisly, it's going to sound yuck, but I had talked to somebody in the court system back in New York State, and there was an ongoing case with an inordinate number of bodies that had gone missing from the morgue.
Oh.
Okay, this is 92, 93.
This is not around Halloween, I take it.
No, this was in the spring, okay, because I wrote this article about that and missing, you see, now this is where I really stepped into it, missing children. You would be shocked at the number of adolescents that go missing during a year.
Actually, no. I know the number is huge. I know most of the cases are not solved. I also know that no one seems to be making a big fuss over it. That's the part that I find astonishing.
Right. And that's exactly what I put in my article, along with the missing bodies, the mutilation cases that I had found out. Also, you remember when the huge UFO case was happening over the Hudson Valley?
Mm-hmm. At night, and they eventually claimed that it was a bunch of paragliders or whatever, all in synchronization with their lights twinkling and doing formation flying.
Right. Well, there were so many dairy cows that were being mutilated.
In the Hudson Valley?
In the Hudson Valley.
At this time?
During this time frame.
Fascinating.
That the contact that I talked to, now I wasn't there. I didn't see this. Okay. I'm just going on what this fellow told me. And I knew the guy, I knew who he was, and I had absolutely no reason to think that he would lie to me.
So you had a calibration of a source?
Yes. He said that the government, and he didn't specify what part of the government, and we all know the government is not this monolithic entity, but somebody was flying cows into New York.
What?
To replace the mutilated cows.
What?
Yeah. This is what I was told.
By this guy that you trusted because you've known him a while.
Right.
Right. So they were to what? To basically make the cattle mutilations go away? In other words, they would bury the mutilated cow and they replace it with a fresh Holstein?
With a fresh cow.
Oh yes. My God. Yeah. This is like three card Monte with cows.
Yeah. So anyway, we are at the MUFON, Vicky and I are at the MUFON International Symposium, which was being held down in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just as this new issue of UFO Magazine is coming out. And we're walking down a hall, and this is just as Whitley Strieber was finishing one of his presentations. And they apparently, he and his wife, who unfortunately just passed away. Okay.
I know,
Ann Strieber just recently passed away. But they apparently had read my article and were outraged. Now, you got to remember, Whitley has gone through phases.
Well, he had a cabin there in upstate New York.
Right. But he had gone through phases that the abductions were benign, the abductions weren't benign.
Right.
You know, the ETs are good, they're not good. I God only knows where he is now. But as Vicki and I are walking past this hall where he just gave his presentation, Whitley and his wife saw us and came running out the door, screaming and ranting and raving at us for daring to publish this in UFO magazine.
Really?
That's the upshot to that, yeah.
And let me get this straight. He was objecting to you publishing the idea with evidence of human mutilations paralleling the cattle.
Oh, you better believe it.
And that was what was up his, you know what?
Oh, yeah. He was upset. So I got to tell you, it had been a long time after that I spoke to Whitley, that I would speak to Whitley. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's one of these crazy things.
Well, wait, let me back up. Why was he upset? Why were they upset?
Well, I guess at the time they thought that the ETs were benign and good.
So we're looking at another example of ignoring evidence staring us in the face because our model is different than the evidence.
Yeah. Okay. And that's one of the problems in this field at all. So we, you know, and in 2006, that's when both Vicki and I bailed out of active research. And that's been, good God, that's been, what, 9 years ago?
Mm.
And it's been...
how time flies when you're having fun.
Well, I wrote a paper.
Do you miss it?
Do I miss it? No.
Oh.
But I wrote a paper that is available on the web that people may wish to track down and read, called My 20 Years in the UFO Fog. And it's chock full of anecdotes, photographs, people, places, things that we experienced during our tenure of shepherding that process from start to finish.
Hmm.
The UFO process and UFO magazine.
Well, why don't you, give us some highlights from the paper? I was going to eventually get to where are we tonight, Don? You and I have been at this a very long time. We've tracked through your history, which obviously is grounded in real investigative procedures and bringing that to a realm that is, it just doesn't stand still. I like the term fog because, yeah, but after all these decades, what's your bottom line? What are we dealing with, and are we any closer now than we've been for decades to finding out?
Well, you know, if you are honest with yourself, okay, to thine own self be true, Dick. If you are honest with yourself, you've got to look at the whole picture and then attempt to come to a conclusion. I started out this process firmly in the nuts and bolts camp.
Mm-hmm.
I was convinced that if this phenomena were real, then the only thing then, to my thinking, that would explain it would be a nuts and bolts craft.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I still think that is one aspect to it. But my thinking has evolved to other explanations. For example, I became pretty good friends with Ingo Swann. You know who?
Ingo? Yeah, sure.
Ingo Swann was the guy that put together the protocols at Stanford Research for the CIA and the Department of Defense, put together the protocols for remote viewing. He was literally one of the most gifted psychics in the world, and he did it for many, many years, and his hits are so impressive. If you know anything about Ingo Swann and what he did, I mean, the guy was amazing. And
well, he was the first guy that I know with his flaming red hair. He actually viewed and predicted and sketched artificial structures on the moon. He also looked at Mars and said there's stuff there.
Well, that's how we met.
Yeah.
You know, I've been, since about 1991, 92, I've been involved in lunar research and lunar transient phenomena. As a matter of fact, that...
good old Joseph Goodacre's work.
Yeah, that show that was on last year, God, and I was the research producer on it. It's up on Netflix now, on Lunar Mysteries, Moon Mysteries. I came across some evidence back in the mid-90s that I finally released on that program. Among many other photographs and things that I've gotten from NASA archives and what have you, that show artificial, beyond any doubt in my mind, artificial structures on the moon's surface. Now, what does that ultimately mean? Does it mean that there are extraterrestrials there now? Possibly. Does it mean that it might have been some base, for the want of a better term, that was put together in the distant past? Possibly. Is it possible that we, as the human species, the human race, Homo sapiens sapien, may have achieved great technological feats many thousands of years ago that were wiped out in some catastrophic event, but our ancestors at some point went to the moon? Possibly. I mean, all of these are viable options in my book. Okay? They're all possible. But I have no doubt that at some point there was intelligence situated on the moon. Now,
have you seen the latest Chinese data?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was buried pretty deep in that. You know, they want to go back there. They want to have a manned mission there by 2020.
I know. And they're also looking at sample returns. They want to bring the stuff back that they found. And, of course, if you go to enterprisemission.com, which is our Enterprise website, and you look at the top of the scroll down two or three stories, you'll see a major story, major banner, what the Chinese really discovered on the moon. Because, Don, they took CCD color imaging, which shows exactly the same geometry and morphology and like characteristics of the glass ruins that the Apollo guys photographed on film, not CCDs, but film, you know, 40, 50 years before.
Right. Well, you know, when you talk about the moon, and I mean, that is one of my favorite topics. I have been banging around lunar research for a very long time now. And I created, as a matter of fact, Jim Oberg is on my case right
now. He's on everybody's case.
Yeah, but he's especially on mine. He doesn't like it when I talk about the moon. So, but for example, okay, and these are some of the things that I throw out. They're really meant to make people think about this. Because unfortunately, Dick, you and I both know, people very seldom take the time to really think about things. The moon was the piece de la resistance, the American space program in the 1960s. We were in a life and death race with the former Soviet Union to get the first astronauts up there. I've got copies of National Geographic and all kinds of magazines from that time, all talking about what was possible, putting manufacturing bases on the moon, the stuff that we could get there, helium-3, for example, quicker, faster, better. I mean, all these things.
Did you ever read a book on that subject by a friend of mine named Neil Rusick? He was editor and publisher of a trade magazine called Industrial Design. So he was heavily involved with aerospace and also non-aerospace industries. He wrote a whole exquisite book just about the time that Apollo 11 landed, because I know, because I had him as a guest at CBS, called Where the Winds Are All Asleep. And the book is a very small book, but a very powerful book. His name is Neil Rusick, R-U-Z-I-C. And it basically was a outline of how to industrialize the moon using 1960s technology and thereby remove the environmental burdens, provide new energy sources, provide materials that you could only make in a vacuum, an incredibly hard vacuum like on the moon.
Right.
All that planning, all that forecasting, all that projection of what we would do with this newfound capability, remember, I was there. It all went away.
Well, let me speculate a little bit on why that may have happened. Okay, and I'm going to look that book up, Dick.
The winds are all asleep.
I'm going to look that up. When Apollo 11 touched down on the moon. Now, of course, everybody should know that they encountered an unknown anomaly about halfway between Earth and the moon. Okay.
What do you mean?
Buzz Aldrin.
You mean a craft, something in space that was trailing them.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one of those inconvenient facts that we're not going to talk. But here are some other facts that, boy, when I first broadcast this on my original radio show, Dick, which you were a guest on four or five times.
At least.
What was tonight? The first astronauts that went to the moon, ladies and gentlemen, were armed. Okay? They had weapons.
Let me stop you there. What's your source on this?
NASA.
Where?
After I got their spokesperson. To admit it, huh?
Which spokesperson?
Oh, Jesus.
It's in your notes somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is.
You'll send it to me tomorrow, but this is a very crucial thing.
Savage? Oh, this is now a publicly known fact, Dick. And what NASA told me, okay, when I asked about this, was, well, why would these astronauts be armed? Now, you got to know a little more about this overall case.
Do we know what they were armed with?
45 caliber pistols.
Okay. Well, I can think of a benign explanation, but go, tell us.
And they gave me a benign explanation. Where do you hear it, though?
Okay.
Where do you hear it? But first, let me tell you that for over 400 years, world-class astronomers have been observing on the moon anomalous events, all kinds of anomalous events. And NASA contracted, okay, to a think tank back in the mid-60s to do a study on these lunar anomalies. It's called NASA TR-277.
Is that the one authored by Barbara Middlehurst?
Yes.
Yeah, that was out of Goddard.
Right.
Goddard Space Flight Center.
Now, what did they show in there? Well, they showed lunar anomalies by date, the astronomer that reported them, the geographical location on the moon, and what the astronomer witnessed. Now, if you're interested in this, it's online. You can find it on the web, okay? But they knew that something was happening up there, and Dick, you should recall this.
I mean, come on.
You remember
this? Are we interested? Is the Pope a Jesuit?
Yeah.
Of course we're interested. Now, some of this data went back hundreds of years. I mean, I remember there's an observation by Sir William Herschel, who was a brilliant giant of an astronomer, created the first huge reflecting telescopes, mapped the sky. He reported looking at the moon and seeing these, like what he called smoldering coals or red embers on the night side that you can see from Earth when it's an Earthshine.
Right.
And this is like hundreds of years ago, something active, dynamic, changing on the dead moon.
But you remember in the 60s, do you remember the movable domes that astronomers were watching?
Yeah, sure.
They would be in one place for a couple of weeks. Suddenly, the next night, they'd be gone. They'd reappear somewhere else. Nobody had a clue what this was. So, you know, when I discovered that astronauts had carried firearms to the moon.
Yeah, but lest we leave people with the weird impression, remember in those days, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, as part of their training, they would dump astronauts on deserted islands, assuming that when they came down in the Pacific, the fleet wasn't there to pick them up, And they were lost, like Carpenter. Remember, Carpenter landed long, and he was lost for like 4 or 5 hours, maybe 6 hours. So they equipped them for survival on islands, which included
this is
a sidearm.
This is what NASA told me. Well, in the event when they're returning from the moon,
right,
and they land in an inhospitable jungle,
right,
okay,
which could have happened.
They would have,
yeah.
Dick, where did they aim these guys to come down? In the middle of the bloody ocean?
Not exactly. No. It was all over the map in the Pacific because the lighting changed, the seasons changed, the sun angles, the weather, the ITCZ.
But they could follow these guys from the second that they began
It took them 6 hours to find Carpenter, and that was in the South Atlantic, and we had zillions of radar and a whole fleet out there.
But we never had a problem.
But it could have.
Well, it's possible.
Remember,
sure.
NASA always was, you know, no single point failure. So if you have guys coming back and they wind up on a desert island, they need a gun to shoot something so they can eat.
Well, let's not get lost in the weeds. So the bottom line was,
I mean, you're assuming they're there to guard against ETs when they land,
I find it odd that they would give those. You know those capsules that they landed in on the moon,
mm-hmm.
the lunar module,
right.
Was nothing more than damn near plastic.
No, it's even worse. It was tinfoil. And we shall pick this up right after the bottom of the hour. We are at a break. Don't go away, because Don and I are going to talk about something really amazing when we come back.
You'd remember something I said to you, played for you, or wrote you in a letter. It might be a tone of hope, telling you how important you and your music are. I'd like to play a song for you. It would become a part of you. To give my love, to give my heart, with music flowing from my heart. The song I sing, our love would bring. The music sweet in concert ring. Forever to glow, forever we'll know. Music flowing from my heart. My music will give you the courage to love. My music will be as a strength from above. My musical soul will deliver. A garden of pleasure, a treasure forever. A chapel of song, a mission of love.
We are back on the other side of midnight. While we were at the break, I took a look at some of the email coming in. And apparently, you and I both missed this because the president has been in touch with the guys in England, in France, and apparently there is something being planned at the White House. So, you know, Yahoo and Google are your friend.
That's great. That's great. That's the way it should be.
Of course it should be. And I would have been stunned if it wasn't that way, because it's an incredible teachable moment. We have so much fear. We are living in the middle of fear porn about everybody trying to do us in. And I wish everybody would take a real deep breath, stand back, and look at what it's doing to the country. You know, we have candidates now talking about rounding up 12 million people and deporting them, obviously clueless that the kind of police action, Don, that would be required to do that would destroy the fabric of the United States of America quicker than anything else. Anything.
There's nothing in the world I hate more than the political season. I get to the point where they start talking politics on radio or, you know, on the television, and I tune out.
But you see, I think part of that's by design. How do you take over a country? You take it over by getting all the good people to quit, be disgusted, to stay home, to become apathetic, and then you have a few torchlight ceremonies for the initiated, and they wind up taking your country.
Yeah.
So you need more participation. Part of the hallmark of this show is participation. That's why I want you to get an app, and I want you to come back on tomorrow night, and I want you to talk as part of our conversation about the Hillary server, because there are some things you may not know about the Hillary server that are crucial to understanding this incredible, dramatic drama going on in front of us now in terms of this election cycle. Forget all the others. This election cycle is like none other you have ever lived through, and we haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah, I just can't wait for the other shoe to drop. Oh, my God. Hey, but anyway, what do you say we get back to the moon?
Yeah.
So, the moon, okay, Apollo 11 lands, and it was a day I will never, ever forget in my life. I was glued.
Me neither.
I was glued to the tube, and Walter Cronkite. It was one of the most, you know, and I can remember that night, or either that night or the next night, going out and looking up in the sky and thinking to myself, my God, we've got men up there.
I know.
It was just an amazing thing.
You've never heard my experience of that night, have you? I was in Los Angeles. I was in actually in a little town south, Downey, California, south of Los Angeles, at the North American Rockwell facilities. Those are the folks that actually made the command and service module for the Apollo program. And I had built, at the insistence of my executive producer, once I convinced him, a walk-through solar system in this huge hangar there in Downey the night of the landing. And some of the people that I shared that landing with, among others, was Robert Heinlein. And Robert and I walked over to the doors of this huge hangar with these, must have been 50, 60, 70-foot high doors, the kind that open, you know, slide sideways. And because it was a very hot summer evening, we had the doors open and this solar system that we were using as a set. And in the corner of the hangar by these huge doors was a large black and white monitor. And on that monitor, we saw Buzz and Neil bouncing around. And Robert and I stood there looking out the hangar door at the real moon while simultaneously this incredible picture was coming back from the moon on that TV, you know, monitor. And he looked at me and I looked at him and he said, Dick, from this moment on, this marks the beginning of the year one of the new era of the human race. And we haven't got there yet.
If he only had been correct.
Yep.
Well, my point is, so we only go there a total of six landings. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Leave the moon in December of 72 after Apollo 17. No, there wasn't.
No, there wasn't.
As far as I can determine, an Apollo 18 or an Apollo 20.
I'm glad we agree. No, there was
not. But 17.
Do you know why, by the way, Dan, it had to end on Apollo 17?
Well, I know that there were other missions that had already been budgeted. I know that the equipment, the rockets were built.
Yep.
They're still lying, you know, down on the pad, okay, just rusting away.
Well, one's in Houston and one's on the lawn in Houston. It's the world's biggest lawn ornament.
Exactly.
And the other is in a demonstrative position there at the Cape Canaveral.
I know that the astronauts were trained. All they had to do was set the rocket up, put them in the capsule, and light the fuse. And they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And their explanation, well, the American public lost interest in the moon. We know everything there is to know about the moon. They lost interest. Now, Dick, I can tell you this from personal experience. I lost interest in the Republic of Vietnam 15 minutes after I landed there. But you know what? That drug on for 15 years.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
15 years.
Yeah, great nations do not, with randomness, choose or unchoose targets. They've spent the equivalent now of, what, $100 billion to make Apollo happen.
And we totally pulled our wings in. We stopped going to space until Skylab. And then it was only low Earth orbit.
Yep. Safe. Okay. Very safe.
Now,
no danger of seeing, unless someone comes knocks on the door, there's no danger of seeing anything you're not supposed to see.
Doesn't that raise the hackles on the back of your neck?
Well, of course. Of course. Look, we know the system is fixed. My question to you tonight, as we have, 20 minutes left, slightly less, is after all these decades doing this, after seeing all kinds of situations and cases and doing comparisons like your pattern analysis on the human mutilations, what's the bottom line? What are we dealing with, and when will we get to know it officially from some government source?
We won't, and we won't.
Okay.
It's called the mushroom syndrome. They keep you in the dark, buried under copious amounts of BS, and that's it. I mean, that is it in a nutshell. The only way I I've said this forever, and, you know, hey, I am not just assigning this to nuts and bolts craft, maybe coming from another star system. Interdimensional travel, which I began to think may also be feasible. You know, I started to talk about Ingo Swann, and I was going to relay some things we were discussing in great depth, some remote viewing. And then the ranch out in Utah that the Bigelows, you know, are behind, and the NIDS people and what they experienced out there before the plug was pulled. These are all things that would seem to suggest there are a lot of possibilities going on, but the powers that be, I am convinced, will go to their graves grasping these secrets to their breast for whatever reason they have. Perhaps they honestly believe they are saving us from a mind-numbing fear. I don't know.
Hang on, because this is what I wanted to get to, and I didn't know that it would be introduced this way so elegantly. Don, you were involved directly in impelling me directly to find the piece of legal government documentation which explains the rationale for all of the cover-up. Do you want to tell folks about it?
Yeah. Well, back in about 1991 or 92, at UFO Magazine, one day I had a call from Mr. Richard Hoagland. And Dick said, hey, Don, he said, I'm working with Stan McDaniel on a project here. We are trying to get NASA to not only agree to put a camera on their Mars probe, but we want to get this thing opened up. And anyway, I understand there was a document prepared for the brand new NASA way back in the day when they were first being formed, 60, 61, somewhere in there. And he said, what do you think you could maybe locate this or track it down? And I said, well, okay, I'll give it a shot and see what happens. And lo and behold, I discovered the Brookings document.
Yep.
And I called Dick up, and I said, well, Dick, this is what it is, and the peaceful exploration of outer space, blah, 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 blah. And, it was the Brookings document prepared for NASA circa 1961. And go get them, Tiger. what was in that document was breathtaking, because they were then, in 1960-61, talking about not if, but when. Not if, but when we discover either ET artifacts or actual ET life.
Remember when they predicted we would find it?
Yeah, 20 years.
20 years. How the hell? I mean, to me now, I'm saying that's a rounded up 19.5, but continue.
Yeah, so, you know, it basically boiled down to this. The people that put this document together at Brookings said there would be two types of people that would be adversely affected, that would be devastated if this information came. It would be fundamentalist religious people, and they didn't specify whether it was Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or whatever, just people with a fundamentalist bent, and engineers and scientists would be devastated.
Hmm.
So, we now come to the uncomfortable conclusion. What do we do? Do we tell them or do we hide it? Well, I think it's pretty evident, Dick, what they did.
Right.
They decided to hide it.
The question is how long?
Until forever.
Well, see, I don't quite agree with you there, because if you read Brookings, which I've done several times, there is a prescription for a massive public educational program covering film, radio, television, newspapers, magazines, comic books, everything.
I've been hearing that since I've been involved in this smokescreen.
But we've been seeing it. Look at the last 50 years of media, starting with my friend Gene Roddenberry, going through Star Wars, Kubrick.
Let me tell you about Roddenberry. Roddenberry discounted entirely the whole idea of UFOs, ETs. He thought it was nonsense. I got that directly from another guy that you know, who was one of the screenwriters on Star Trek, not to mention the producer of Fire in the Sky, Tracy Torme.
Mm-hmm.
He got into a knockdown shootout, metaphorically speaking, with Roddenberry, because Roddenberry resented the fact that Tracy Torme had an interest in this.
Mm. You think that's the explanation, huh?
Absolutely.
Well, hang on. Don, there are no such things as absolutes. Let me give you some contravening information.
Well, in my purview, it's absolutely correct.
Okay, well, see, from my point of view, it's not, and here's why. When I discovered the stuff at Sedonia for sending off, Vince Molinar
Pietro.
Pietro, thank you. One of the people that I turned to help me put together an investigation was Gene. You know, we knew each other. We'd known each other for decades, and he invited me down, and I saw the whole, setup for Second Generation. I told him at that time, of course, that he was never going to make it, that he couldn't redo his success with Star Trek, the original, and I was wrong, but he was a very nice guy, very nice, and we spent all day together, and he took me to the commissary, and we had a great lunch, and went back to his office, and we laid out all the images that I had of Sedonia on his office floor, and I sat on the couch, and he sat behind his desk, and we talked about image after image after image after image, and I asked him to help me figure out what this was, and he looked at me. This was after he said something really astonishingly interesting to me. Most astonishingly important thing I think almost anybody has ever said, which was, but Dick, if this was real, pointing to the floor and all the photographs of Sedonia and the face and the pyramids and all that, he said, if this was real, it would be on television. That's the first thing. The second thing he said, which I thought to this day, of course, till I figured out what he meant by it, when I asked him point blank, can you help? He said, Dick, I don't want to complicate my life. Now, that's not the words of a guy that doesn't know what's going on and doesn't have political boundaries and doesn't have, restraints on what he can say and what he can't say and what he can get into and what he can't get into. And that was my first insight into Gene's hidden life. So I think that your friend and your report from Tracy could be, tinged by the realities that Roddenberry was facing behind the scenes as someone who was critically important in American culture at a critical time in our history, who did not want to complicate his life.
Well, you know, that's possible. I certainly will not discount that.
Well, this is a firsthand report. I knew Gene very well. I made pancakes for him and Majel at their Beverly Hills mansion one morning. So like for him to tell me that told me a lot more than that. It was, this is a red flag. Don't get involved, for God's sake, and don't get me involved. It's kind of like you and the mutilations. Nobody wanted to hear from Gene Roddenberry. He was seriously interested in what, for them, was fiction. And he wanted to keep it that way because I think he did have back channels, and I think he knew a lot more about a lot more things, but that's to be proved in the future.
Well, it's like Phil Klass, okay? Now, there was no...
Well, now, Roddenberry and Phil are in no way similar at all.
No. But listen to me make my point.
Okay.
I think Klass is dismissive and as nasty and as vicious as he could be toward UFO proponents.
Mm-hmm.
Secretly, I am convinced he was terrified that it might be real.
I knew Phil. I met him back when no one else knew of him. He was working on books, and at that time I kind of suggested he work on a book on comprehensive satellite reconnaissance and how it had saved planet Earth.
Right.
And he went and published the book and said that, because he could back it up, a lot of research. He was a very mainstream kind of guy. He was the kind of guy that, yes, would have been terrified, because if it was real, it meant everything he thought he knew meant nothing.
Well, you know,
and his ego was pretty attached to what he thought he knew.
He exploded on my radio program screaming BS.
Really?
And it wasn't BS that he was saying.
Okay.
All right, back in January of 1995. And we were talking about the Washington, D.C. overflights in 1952.
The famous 52 incidents.
And he was telling me, well, if the Air Force would have really been interested, if they really thought these were real, if they really, it took them over an hour to get jets there. And I said, yeah, because they had to fly in from Delaware, Phil.
What do you mean?
I said, well, all the Air Force bases at the time in the Washington, D.C. area were being resurfaced.
Like Andrews.
I got that from none other than Al Chop. You know who?
Yeah, Al Chop was the Air Force public affairs officer.
Exactly. And Klass melted down right there and hung up on me.
On the air.
So.
Well, I had General Walker walk out on me. Remember General Walker? Way, 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 way back in the 60s, General Walker? General Walker of the Kennedy assassination era?
Right.
I got him to actually walk off my show because I asked too many damn hard questions.
Well, you know, it's like that. You know, by their fruits.
You always want that.
Ye shall know them.
Yep.
And there it is.
So no, but I would certainly put Gene and Klass in totally separate categories because Gene knew stuff that he couldn't talk about. Klass knew stuff he was terrified of.
Well, apparently accumulated quite an FBI file on him. You know, he was digging around in secret spy satellite technology and that's all the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But this isn't a show about Phil Klass, but he's another one that left the stage. So rest in peace. It's the secret now, Dick.
Well,
maybe. Knows.
We are about 2 minutes away from the end of the show, and we are about 23 hours away from, or 22, from what I want to do at the Clinton stuff tomorrow night. So think about whether you want to join our conversation.
Yeah, have your producer give me a call sometime tomorrow.
Sure will, or I will call you myself.
Okay.
Since we haven't talked in too long. Finally, any final thoughts on this chapter in Don Ecker, UFO Investigator?
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact. Now, along with my investigations, I've been a broadcaster since 1991, Dick. And the last actual time we talked, and this is kind of funny because in all those years I've been a radio host and an interviewer, you've been a radio guest and an interviewee. How does it feel to have the shoes switched?
It's weird. I'm still trying to get used to it, because it's like I obviously want to focus on content and conversations and what we're discussing, and I've got all this technology I've got to keep track of. Like, we've got less than a minute till music is going to start out of somewhere. So, final thoughts, and I mean it.
Well, my final thought is this. 3 or 4 years ago, it was the last time you and I talked, I got in touch with you, and I said, Dick, I said, it's about time you come on Dark Matters Radio, my radio show. What do you say? Well, Don, I'm waiting for a call from George Norrie to go on Coast to Coast. I'll get back to you. Well, I guess you're still waiting for that call, Dick, because I never heard a damn word from you.
Do you want me to come on your show?
I did. Yes, I do.
Well, you have one now, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'll come on.
All right.
Okay.
Now that that's settled.
anything else?
No, that's pretty much it.
Okay. Well, look, it's been a hell of a nice night to have you on. We obviously have to do this again soon. I will call you tomorrow. You will take a nap. And I think your contribution tomorrow night could be very useful, because we don't have yet a certified actual investigator with credentials that can crack cases, and we need your expertise. And on that note, the music has begun. I thank everyone for joining us in this new odyssey on the other side of midnight. We'll see you tomorrow. Stay tuned.